All right.
Take your Bible and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse number 1. Jeff read it earlier, so we're not going to read it again, but I want you to have it there close so that you can refer back to it as we look at the text. And I think I'll just keep my peanut butter and jelly up here for you so that if I don't get real good at getting what Paul says, you may remember what we talked to the kids about. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 1. I wonder, have you ever had a conversation, maybe a letter that didn't go so well? Maybe you were trying to communicate something, and you're trying to work out an issue, work out a problem, and it seemed like whatever you said or however you said it, it just didn't go right. You ever have one of those? And you kind of worried about how the other person would respond to it, and so you kind of thought back through it, and you probably replayed every word you wrote, and you kept worrying, should I have used a different word? Would another word have been better? And you kind of get word back that maybe the person that you sent that letter to, you were talking to, maybe didn't take it as bad as you thought, and you felt a little bit of relief. You ever have one of those moments? You just weren't sure about how that was going to work. Well, if you kind of can get that picture in your mind, then you really can get the relationship between Paul and the Christians in Corinth. We've talked about it now for a bit because we looked at some passages from 1 Corinthians. Now we're going to spend about 5 weeks in 2 Corinthians, and we're going to kind of look at some themes that were going on in the letter. But if we don't kind of get a grasp of really what's going on, because sometimes, you know, we read the Bible and we come to these letters and we forget that they're letters, and we actually forget that there are always relationships behind the letters, that this isn't just like letters on a page, but what we're reading represents some real emotions, deep feelings, certain intentions. And so while we get it and we read it on the page and we kind of maybe take away a few ideas, we can never escape the fact that Paul and the church at Corinth were having a really, really difficult time communicating to one another. In fact, we mentioned when we first started in 1 Corinthians that there's conjecture that there were at least four letters that went back and forth. And if you looked over in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, you would find out that Paul makes reference to a difficult letter. And we're not sure where that letter went. Some think that maybe there are bits of it that show up in what we have in 2 Corinthians, but likely most think that that was a letter that just wasn't included. Maybe we never got a copy of that, but it was a really what we called your translation, if you had, I think the King James may say, severe letter. Now, if you were to hear someone say, I talked severe to someone, wouldn't that kind of communicate really hard and maybe harsh sounding? So as we look at these passages in 2 Corinthians, keep in mind that there's a deep relationship behind what's going on. And when Paul begins this letter, he really is drawing on that relationship and the difficulty that's had. Started out really well when the missionaries showed up in Corinth. A lot of folks really, as Paul said, it turned from idols to the living God. They really embraced the good news of the missionaries. A church was planted. We probably ought to have in mind this too, that when Paul starts talking about church, he probably has in mind, at least in Corinth, groups that met in homes that would then get together as a large assembly. They didn't have buildings like we do. It was actually not legal in some places. In fact, at a point in time, it became against the law, really. Christianity was an illegal religion for almost 300 years. And so our idea is, as we kind of transport ourselves back in time, we start hearing church, and we may think building. It wasn't building, it was people. Hopefully today you do also recognize the church isn't building, it's people. It's people who hear that good news, we get together, and we hope that we are being faithful in what we do to live out the way of Jesus in the world, drawing attention to that good news in hopes that somebody really might realize that there is a way God dreams and designs for people to live that really revolutionizes not just their own lives, but their entire world. And that's really, really what the good news is aimed at. The good news is not aimed at just an exclusive reference to you or to me, but to us, really to all people. And so as a consequence, we have to kind of keep some of these things in mind because our habits of reading the Bible have come to us such that we often read them as though we read them for ourselves. We don't read them for the fact that they're written as a collective to groups of people, and then as we read them to a much wider audience. So if we can kind of keep some of those things in mind, I think the things Paul describes here will jump a little bit off the page. I hope they do. I hope they become more than print in black and white, but really a recognition that when Paul says God is the God of all comfort, and the way that he has been comforted in turn gives him the opportunity to comfort others, that becomes something that we actually embrace. Not as an idea, not as a philosophy, but actually as a practice. Now, I don't mind that people want to write books about compassion and empathy and those sorts of things that kind of tell us how that all functions and works. But listen, this is a practice. It is a practice that forms us. It shapes us so that when we make a commitment to be with others in difficult times, it changes us. It shapes us. And certainly it does them. We had a tragic accident just out here in front of the church this past week. And if you could have seen the intense longing to be a help to that young man by the folks who work in that little in the gas station, in the restaurant, and work over there who happened to be pumping gas when that happened. So much so that they made phone calls to say, we know we want someone to be with that young man. Do you understand that is a way that shapes us? It shouldn't take that particular kind of event for us to make a commitment to other people. But it certainly should be that when that kind of event comes, we're the kind of people that show up. So if we kind of got that, if I don't capture everything else, let's just say together, we'll adopt being with others, comforting others, will be a practice we participate in because it changes us and our world. Good? Okay. So let's talk about how that works for Paul, because Paul does some things that I have to tell you from time to time. If you've read the phrase, you've probably wondered, what does he mean by that? So for Paul, the grounding of the idea of comfort or encouragement, because the word that's comfort can also be encouragement, the thing that grounds Paul in that awareness is his own experience of suffering. Now, I have to tell you that we live in a particular culture that does everything it can to avoid suffering. N.T. Wright says that Western culture, which takes in Western Europe and the United States, says that we are addicted to happiness. That is, we'll do everything we can to pursue happiness, and we do so, and we do so in such a way and to such a degree, we will minimize suffering. In fact, we'll almost overlook and ignore it because we're pursuing the next happy thing we get to experience. And what comes off is really kind of a single-dimensional understanding of the way the world works and how we experience. If all we're pursuing is happiness, then understand something. The way we communicate the gospel leads people to believe that we're always happy. And as a pastor, I can assure you, you're not always happy. It's just not natural for us. There are certain circumstances and events that come our way that are exceedingly difficult. And the idea of happiness just defies the opportunity or possibility when those sorts of things come. So Paul liked to use this phrase, the sharing in the sufferings of Christ. Philippians 3 is a place that we may be pretty familiar with. And Paul is giving his resume. He's giving his, here's kind of who I am. And if you're not careful, you read it as though Paul is really kind of being arrogant. He's talking about himself. He's building himself up. But his concluding thought is this: even though I've got a great resume, I want you to know I consider it all to be, and I can't use the word. The cleaned up version is dung. But in the Greek, it's not cleaned up. We just don't like to translate it for our own sensibilities. Are you with me? Okay, just want to make sure I don't have to draw any more pictures. And so when he does that, what he's saying is all of this stuff is like that stuff. And he says, because really what I'm after is, and he goes through these, I really want to know him and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made like him even unto his death. Now, I have to tell you something. If you're going around sharing good news and you're telling people that the end commitment that you're going to make in life is to share in the fellowship of someone's sufferings, even to the point of the likeness of his death, I'm pretty sure they're going to look at you and go, try again. You're not selling that here. I'm not buying. But if you really think about it, it is really the thing that we do. And a quick side note, the missiologist Leslie Newbegin, who spent 50 years in India, he came back to England, and he came back to the West. And he was so startled by what he saw in the church that he decided after visiting the United States, he would consider what it is that tends to motivate us. And so he actually took one of our founding documents that says that we believe God gave, and of course, if you read it in its context, it means that he only gave certain human beings certain rights, but we call them inalienable rights. You familiar? I mean, this is, you know, election year, so we should probably be remembering these inalienable rights that we have. You know, what are they? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, you do understand that the pursuit of happiness was a change. It was supposed to be the inalienable right of property. But guess what? If you decided to put in your document that it was an inalienable right for everyone to have property, those who wanted to have more property wouldn't be able to have more property. So what's easier? Well, we'll tell everybody it's a God-given right for you to be happy. That way you don't have to worry about the fact that you don't have things. That's really what happened. The shift was such that what we said was, oops, those who were making the rules, those who were setting the agenda, recognize that if we include property, that means that everybody might have something. And we can't have that. We've got to make sure we have more than everybody else has. And so Leslie Newbegin, when he was applying kind of an understanding of how Christianity actually got co-opted by that idea, said, we've presented a good news that convinces everybody that really what Jesus is all about is making you happy. And we're addicted to it. And our addiction to happiness actually can't be satisfied. That is the definition of addiction. I mean, the definition of addiction means that there is something that is going on in your being that you got to have. Now, my friend and yours, some of you remember Tyrone Smith and his son Karsten. Well, some of you know Karsten's story. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't mind mentioning this. In fact, he would probably have liked it had I had him come give the illustration himself. You know, Karsten, when he was in high school, he got involved in drugs. He got involved in methamphetamines. He got involved in some other drugs, and he actually began selling them. And not long out of high school, he got arrested, and he went to prison. He went to jail for it. And while he was in jail, he recognized he had this problem. And so Tyrone and Vicky, they're music ministers, Baptist music ministers. That means they don't make a lot of money. You with me? Right? Yes? Well, they found the money to find him a place, an in-treatment facility over in Seminole, former NFL football player. He spent 30 days. And he got out and he began making AA meetings, not one time a week, but multiple times a week. And after he worked through that 12 steps, which Dallas Willard says is probably the best spiritual formation tool we have available. So before you kind of shun the idea of that whole program, you probably ought to go read it. As Willard says, that if you really practice it as a Christian, you will understand what spiritual transformation really looks like if you engage that. Anyway, that's another footnote. I've got two footnotes so far. And so what happens is he began to experience accountability, and he had to learn the things. And so we were helping Jerry. Some of you remember Jerry, baptized Jerry right in here, bald-headed guy. And that's not bad. I'm almost there. So that wasn't an indictment. But Jerry was a construction worker, builds guardrails up and on highways in the state of Oklahoma. But he got addicted to methamphetamine, started coming to church with his wife. And so they would sit right about there, about third or fourth row, and they would come. And I started meeting with Jerry, and I want you to know something. I was out of my league. So I called Carson. I said, "Carson, I need some help here. What can we do to help this guy?" And he said, "Well, here's what we do." So we got Jerry hooked up with Carson, who got hooked up with a group, and they began meeting. And as far as I know, to this day, Jerry has experienced sobriety. His business is going well. Things are much better in his life than he'd been. But Carson told me something one time. We argued about this, and he won, okay? So I'm just telling you, I don't win all my arguments. He said, "Everyone is an addict. Every human being is addicted to something." And I just fought him on that thing. Hour-long conversations, multiples, until finally I said, "I think you're right." And if Newbegin is right about Western Christianity, we have made religion an addiction to happiness. And what happens is when we face difficulties in life and the happiness we think we're supposed to have because we're now Christians doesn't come, we immediately think something's wrong with our faith or something's wrong with our version of Christianity, because we bought into the idea that our version of Christianity means we're going to be happy all the time. And as a pastor, I'm telling you, you're not happy all the time. Because maybe life just doesn't work that way. Maybe the experiences of life are often more traumatic than we are prepared to experience. And there are many of them. We've had them in this room. We've got families in the room that have had those kind of experiences. We just mentioned Jennifer J's dad a minute ago. Just now going through all the emotions you didn't think you'd go through. I didn't know it, but she just messaged me to say, "This is what's happening. We're starting about 10 o'clock. Would y'all, we're so appreciative of our church family. Keep praying for us." Well, we will, won't we? Yeah, we will. But you see, when suffering comes, we've got to identify that that actually takes in a broad brush. You see, Paul didn't identify what his sufferings were, and it's a good thing. He didn't say he was suffering from the fact that he had been beaten with a cat of nine tails, he had been shipwrecked, he had been in prison. He didn't say that's what his suffering was, though it very well could have been. He had that experience on numerous occasions. Paul didn't say it was a terminal illness, although he talks about a thorn in the flesh that he prayed for God to remove, and most scholars believe, he had some sort of terminal physical event that was a constant reminder of his humanity and his frailty. But he didn't say that was it. He's also, as he's writing this letter, pained so deeply inside by the reaction of his Christian Corinthian friends that he is so wrenched internally by how they've responded to him that it's caused him physical and emotional suffering. He didn't say that's what it was. So I believe that when he wrote the letter, he's encompassing all possibilities of suffering. So lest you start thinking that that Paul's only talking about certain aspects of suffering, he's being all-inclusive. Every kind of human suffering you can imagine. He said, and I have to think that when he talks about the fellowship of Christ's sufferings, he's certainly talking about hanging on a tree and dying. But I think he's also talking about what it is to suffer by taking on the rejection experienced when he came declaring good news, the kingdom is here, and everybody said, "We don't want it." We really like to play up the physical suffering of Jesus on the cross, and it was horrid. But I hope you know by your own experience that there are times where the suffering you experience is often worse than physical pain. Have you had some of those? Where your suffering is worse than physical? In fact, there's some of you, we make light of it sometimes, don't we? We say, well, I'd rather be poked in the eye with a hot needle. You know what we're saying? I'd rather have some sort of physical pain than that. Well, I'd rather you cut some part of my anatomy, cut my hand off if it'd make it better, because I'd rather have physical pain than what really I'm feeling. And when you read Jesus' words, my God, why have you forsaken me? He wasn't talking about bleeding from crown of thorns. And he wasn't talking about that spear in his side. He wasn't talking about the wounds in his hands and his feet. He was talking about the sort of rejection and suffering that comes when he was saying, listen, folks, I've got good news for you. And everybody within listening distance said, no thanks. Not only did they say no thanks, is we don't like what you're peddling. We don't want what you're peddling. And we'd as soon kill you as accept it. I had some pretty deep suffering. Yeah? So if you've ever gone home at night and you've ever had those moments where whatever it is your experience causes you a great deal of suffering, know that I think that Paul would agree and that Jesus gives evidence on the cross that that is more painful than a physical wound you could ever endure. So you see why we really need to learn what it is to be sensitive to people around us? Because it's really easy to see when they can't walk because they've had an injury. Really easy to identify when there's scars and scrapes visibly. Very easy. But if we think that everybody's okay just because their body looks fine, we haven't caught Jesus yet. We haven't paid attention to empathy and compassion yet. And so what grounded Paul in his idea of God's comfort was, in the midst of all the ways he suffered as a human being, he knew God comforted him. I know that that sounds really pious and really lofty, but that's what makes his words more powerful. Because he's speaking out of his own experience. He's speaking out of his own awareness that he can say, you know what, when I was at my lowest, God came alongside me, that's the word, came alongside me and was with me. We have to trust that Paul had a group of people beside him and with him. He talks about Epaphroditus in one letter. And he's telling the folks he's writing to, he said, listen, Epaphroditus was so valuable to me that I actually thought he was going to die. And if he had died, it would have just really, really ruined my experience of life. But praise God, God kept him from dying. And it's not just good for you, but man, it's good for me. Because he's been such an encourager to me. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? That's pretty powerful when someone can recognize the value of another human being and know that's the vehicle through whom God uses to express his grace and his comfort. You see, I know we've said this before and it startles some of you, but I haven't seen God except for when he shows up in people. Remember we talked about the wind and the spirit last week? That we don't know it's wind until we see the effects. The idea that I can say God is at work has to have some tether, has to have some connection. And so when I believe the story in the scriptures and I read what goes on and I read what Paul has been involved in and what he's describing here, now I'm going to start looking for it. And when I see what he's describing, I'm ready to name it. So when I know that Katie was sitting right here and now she's on her way to the hospital, I know what she's doing is going to see her friend Jennifer. That's what she's doing. And she's going to be with her friend. And here's what you ought to observe. That is God showing up. That's what we name.
So when we can say, oh, I don't know God's doing this or God's doing that, I'm just saying we're not looking in the right places or the right ways. We're just not opened up to what's really going on. That is an expression we say, there's God. I see him, there's God. I see him. And so about the time you decide to join all the cynics and skeptics of the world, remember to recalibrate your vision that when you see things going on that are consistent with the descriptions of God at work, you're saying, oh no, I won't be swayed. God is here. He's at work. I just saw it. And someone's experiencing that comfort. Isn't that amen? Man. Now tell me, don't you think that the world would be a different place if there were an army of people ready to do that? I mean, if we could just say, you know what, I can't battle this event, or I can't battle that. I may not be sharp enough to argue every moral objection to this particular issue or that particular issue. I can't make it in the State House or the White House, but I'm going to tell you something. We are putting stock in all the wrong places to make a difference. If we could decide we would be an army that would make that kind of difference in the world would be a different place. In other words, if we actually decided to be that kind of people who said, hey, I'm going to keep my eye out for when you're hurting, and I'm going to be with you. So Paul grounded his encouragement to the Corinthians in his experience of suffering that he connected with Christ's suffering and the comfort that he received. He wants to make sure they know he's ready to give. He commends them later, even though they've had trouble, for the way they were an encouragement to him. So he's ready to say it. So he grounds it in suffering, and then he talks this picture about coming alongside somebody. Now, I think we've described that. That's here's the God of all comfort. He comforts us so that we can comfort others with the same comfort that we've experienced. It sounds like he's maybe talking in circles, but he's simply saying, if you've ever been comforted, now you know how to do it. So here's the thing that happens to us sometimes as Christians. We think, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to comfort someone. And I want to call you on that, okay? I think you do. I think when we say we don't know how to do it, it's because it scares us to do it. I really think it's fear that drives us. You know how to do it because you've experienced. That's what Paul says. Every human being that's ever been encouraged knows how to encourage. It doesn't take rocket science, folks. It doesn't take a seminary degree to figure that one out. It just takes us reading the text and recognizing that what he's saying is the experiences that you've had are given you, are experienced by you, and use them. Use them when you have the opportunity, and I think we actually should make the opportunities as well. So we shared comfort. And I want to get to the last thing we've done, because in verse number 11, he says, you know what? This all really worked out this way. It was your prayers. It was your prayers. Now, we're going to do about 5 weeks in 2 Corinthians. We're going to do about 5 weeks in Job, and then we're going to do the Lord's Prayer as we find it in Luke. So we're going to get the prayer that is part of our summer, what we're going to talk about this summer. But I'm going to give you a glimpse. Listen, I know that prayer is sometimes difficult for you, but listen to me. If you take what Paul says here, what he's saying is when you pray, something happens. And I know that sounds corny, sounds like you've heard it. But listen, I got to tell you, some of us aren't so sure because of the way we've been given to interpret things in our vision of God. Because if we've decided that God's already decided everything, then our prayers really are just getting in line with whatever God's going to do. But Paul says, these prayers are what made the difference. You with me here? Be more specific. We like to say that it's already all figured out. If it is, I'm telling you that prayer is only I don't know what it is at that point. What we like to pacify ourselves is to say that prayer really is something that changes us to be ready to accept what God's doing. But Paul said the reason he survived these sufferings was the comfort and the prayers of the church. In other words, something happens when people pray. Now, I can't explain it except this. God must be a God who responds to prayer. not a God who's out to change your mind about the events. Let me say that again. It must be mean that God is the God who responds, not a God who's out to change your mind how to handle the events. There is a big difference, and it would take through lunch. And you'd probably say no to that. So when we get to the Lord's Prayer in Luke, around August, be ready, because we'll talk about that very thing. But here we mention it for this reason. Don't stop. Don't stop, pray. What was Paul's maxim? Pray without what? Yeah. Now, you do know he didn't mean to just close your eyes and walk around in prayer all the time. I mean, there are walls. But there's this attitude of conversation. There's this attitude of expectation. And there's this attitude that says, hey, guess what? I really believe that God's a responding kind of love because love is a response. In other words, for there to be real love, the person being loved has to have the capacity to respond to that love. And the one who's giving love has to have the capacity to receive what's being expressed in the response of love. In other words, if you got love going on, it's going both ways. And the difference is made in both places. So don't stop. Keep praying because God may do something you never imagined he would do. And I'm not talking about giving you a new car. I'm not talking about paying your mortgage, buying you a new house. I'm talking the kinds of things that were encapsulated in the prayers that Paul was talking about is understanding that the ground of our human experience is common suffering. And the thing that God gives us in each other is someone to walk with us in comfort. And so we ought to always be praying, God, there's someone suffering out there. Okay, I'm ready. God, you've comforted me and you've encouraged me. Put me to work. Because listen, everyone can do that. Say it with me. Everyone can do that. Listen, everyone can do that.